caregivers. As you've heard me say many times on UK Health Radio, caregiving is just not a local issue. It's a universal issue, and it's through story sharing, where diversity meets the road, to collaborate on common cause. And our common cause is supporting caregivers, rather carers, before, during, and after caregiving ends. Over the next few weeks, we will be introducing you to some of my good friends who are making a difference for carers and caregivers all over the world. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Marianne Sacriro, who is the producer and presenter of Untangling Alzheimer's and Dementia. Marianne is the co-founder and director at All's Authors and a registered nurse who cared for hundreds of dementia patients over her 20-year career. Marianne provided care to her stepfather during his dementia journey and witnessed the painful decline of four beloved aunts to the disease. Her novel, Blue Hydrangeas, an Alzheimer's love story, is based on a couple she met through her work and is a testament to the power of love in the face of this heart-wrenching disease. Let me tell you a little bit about All's Authors. All's Authors is a global community of authors writing about Alzheimer's and dementia from a personal experience to light the way for others. Untangling Dementia and Alzheimer's introduces you to the All's Authors who share their stories and insights to provide knowledge, comfort, and support to carers. Another great component about All's Authors is they are a charitable organization, totally reliant on donations for what they do. Their mission is to lift the silence and stigma of Alzheimer's and other dementias. Be sure to check out allsauthor.com. Now it's time for me to turn the microphone over to Marianne. I am sure you're going to enjoy this episode of Untangling Alzheimer's and Dementia.
Harvey and I had been involved in our church for many years, and we had deep connection and deep friendships in this church. And so as I told my friends what was going on, they were very supportive. And like most people do, if there's anything you want, just let us know. If there's anything we can do for you, just let us know. And I never did. But my counselor early on asked me, who is on your team? And I couldn't come up with anybody except my daughters and my parents. And that was not a big enough team. But as time went on, I was vulnerable about what was going on at home with my friends, and they would just offer specific help. So, for example, I played keyboards at my church, and Harvey would come with me and sit while we were practicing, but he started wandering, and our church is downtown and wasn't a particularly, well, it's never a safe thing to do, wander out of a church. So I told a friend that I was going to have to stop playing keyboard in the church. And he said, no, I'll come sit with Harvey during practice. And so Bill became Harvey's, I call him his shepherd, during that time period while I practiced, and then I could meet up with him.
Welcome to the All's Authors Podcast. We're so glad you found us. I'm Marianne Shuko, a registered nurse, author, and dementia daughter. Join me each week to listen to one of our authors talk about their dementia journey, sharing intimate details and painfully obtained knowledge to help others currently on that path. We hope these stories offer you comfort and support as we strive to break the silence and stigma surrounding a dementia diagnosis. May one of our authors speak to your experience. Today's guest is Renee Brown Harmon, MD, author of the teaching memoir, Surfing the Waves of Alzheimer's, Principles of Caregiving That Kept Me Upright. She and her husband, Harvey, created, developed, and shared a thriving family medicine private practice in Birmingham, Alabama, for more than 20 years. In 2010, Harvey, at age 50, was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's and forced to retire. Renee became, quote, the queen of everything, unquote, at work and at home. She was a solo physician at their practice, as well as Harvey's primary caregiver and primary parent to their two teenaged daughters. With reluctance and resentment, she also took on the role of head of household. It was a lot, but she managed to surf the waves, which she shares in her insightful book. Harvey's dementia journey ended in memory care in 2018. Renee retired in 2019 and uses her time and talents to write and speak on Alzheimer's and dementia while advocating for caregivers. In this episode, we discuss how being a physician affected her caregiving journey, how she tried to do it all herself but learned to reach out for help, and the creative ways her friends helped her and Harvey. Hi, Renee. Welcome to the All's Authors Podcast. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you, Marianne. Yeah, doing well.
That's awesome. It's great to finally meet you. I'm sure our listeners are very interested in your book, seeing as you're both a physician and a caregiver to a husband with early onset Alzheimer's. Please tell us about your book.
My husband, Harvey, was diagnosed with younger onset Alzheimer's disease in 2010 when he was 50. We were both physicians. We had an actual practice together. We were family medicine. And when he was diagnosed, he had to quit and retire. So I instantly became a solo practitioner at our practice and manager of our household, a manager at the office, primary parent to two teenage girls, and caregiver to my husband. So that was 2010. And he lived for 8 years, passed away in 2018. And I wrote and published, published it in September 2020.
And I read that you were journaling throughout this whole caregiving time. Is that right?
Absolutely. I found that essential. And that was one of my top self-care things. I had to, because there was nowhere else for me to share what was going on with myself emotionally. I couldn't lay that on my children. I did have friends who could listen, but I couldn't tell my husband all my worries and concerns that revolved around him. So my journal was a place where I could just be brutally honest and lay it all out. But it was also a way for me to chronicle what was happening to Harvey. And so I could go to the physician with these stories. This is what's happened. And then it was just the nidus for a book. It was very helpful to have that journal available to me when I decided to write.
And were you using the journaling as part of your blog?
No, the blog started after Harvey passed away. I use parts of the journal to blog. They're short articles because I feel like caregivers just don't have time to read long blog articles. So they're short articles that have to do with Alzheimer's and caregiving, a variety of things. So it's just pulling from my experience and pulling some things from the book. But it was a way, I did the blog kind of as a way to introduce myself before the book came out, and to gain an audience beforehand. And I'm still gaining subscribers to the blog. It's really nice to see that.
The title of your book is Surfing the Waves of Alzheimer's. Could you describe what you mean by waves?
When you surf, you're just riding on top of the waves. Waves are powerful forces of nature that are destructive. And I knew when my husband was diagnosed that a lot of waves were going to come my way, and I would need to learn how to surf those waves instead of being swamped by the waves, which is what you would do if you didn't have a surfboard and didn't know how to surf. You would just drown in the ocean of waves. So it actually, I've only tried to surf once, and it was on a family vacation to Costa Rica. And incidentally, it was the same vacation when Harvey revealed himself to me to have a problem. And I dislocated my arm when I tried to surf. So that whole story is in the book. But that ended up being a metaphor for me about surfing through whatever waves life brings you. And I also say that, you know, surfing is a solitary sport, but in my case, it felt like, because I had all these friends and neighbors that helped, it felt more like a team sport to help me stay upright on my surfboard instead of getting swamped by everything I had to do and all the changes that were going on with him. And the subtitle is Principles of Caregiving That Kept Me Upright. And I meant upright on my surfboard.
Oh, that's wonderful. You're being a physician. How did that impact you throughout this process? For better or for worse?
Well, I thought that being a physician was going to be, make me just the best caregiver ever. I thought I would have it in the bag. And, you know, it does have advantages. I understood the disease. I understood the progression. I knew the medications that were available and the side effects. But no one's ever prepared to be a caregiver. I knew I was strong. I knew I could handle it. I didn't think that I would ask for help because I was strong and I knew everything there was to know about Alzheimer's, but I didn't know that I was going to have as much help as I did. And so I was reluctant to ask for help, but I learned how to do that. But so yes, definitely advantages to being a physician, but in the end, not a whole lot.
Yeah, it's the same as being a nurse, because I am a nurse and I've worked with dementia patients for years. But then when it struck my own family, I was dumbfounded. Yeah. Because there's so much to do and so much to learn, so much you have to know and into areas that you might not ever have gone into before. And it's overwhelming.
Absolutely. And you know, another thing I realized is that when I am caring for patients and when you care for patients, you could disassociate yourself from them in a way and be professional and provide very good care. But it's when it's your own spouse or your parent, it's a completely different thing. And I was in awe of like the women at Harvey's Respite Care who could just interact with him so beautifully. And I realized they don't have a history with him. This is all they know. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from them. But when you have your whole life history with someone in a certain way and that's changing, it's difficult.
Right. And you're also accustomed to that person fulfilling certain roles in your life together that you count on them to do. And now they're not doing it. They can't do it. So that's something else that falls on your shoulders as well. And there's a lot of emotional stuff involved that you don't get as a professional carer.
Right, exactly. Mm. Yeah, I don't think I was prepared for how much work I was going to have to do. I knew it was going to be hard. And I ended up calling myself the queen of everything. I had to take care of everything. And I was very angry about that because Harvey and I had created this shared medical practice and this shared life at home. We shared raising the children and we shared cooking and cleaning, all of that. And then to all of a sudden have to be in charge of everything was very disorienting and very unbalancing for me.
Yeah. So that's something probably a lot of people go through when a marriage ends or they're widowed or something like that happens and there's a big hole. And yet he was still there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I would remind myself, there are single women out there who do it all. You can do it.
Now you mentioned that your daughters were teens at the time.
They were 14 and 17 years old when he was diagnosed. So our oldest daughter was entering her senior year of high school. So she had to decide about college. And that was a very difficult decision. Do I go away to college, which is what she really wanted to do, or should I stay home? And in the end, she decided that it was okay for her to go away to college. She went to a college 3 hours away and had a wonderful experience and ended up getting a degree in social work. And she is a social worker now. And when she graduated, she did come back home to Birmingham, didn't live at home, but was a big help to me helping with her father. By that time, 4 years later, he was pretty had progressed pretty deeply into his disease. So the 14-year-old probably had the hardest time. And she'll even say today that she doesn't remember much about life before, because she was 14 and she had never heard of Alzheimer's disease before. So she was with us, I guess, 3 years before she went to college, and she helped immensely. I mean, she did a lot of the cooking. She loaded his iPod for him. He would follow her to like the gym at time, and she was tardy to school a few times. She took a lot on her, but I asked a lot of her too. In the end, she decided to go to college in town. She lived on campus though, and was able to have the full experience of being on campus, but I would still call on her when her father had to go to the hospital. She would meet me there, or when he was admitted to geriatric psych, she and my other daughter, we would all meet together. So she didn't have a typical college year, but she, as best as she could, but she is now a special ed teacher. So I think they both were influenced by what was going on with their father, for sure. They're both tender-hearted and have this huge, big heart for the more vulnerable among us. You know, so proud of them.
Yeah, they sound wonderful. How have readers responded to your book and the blog? What kind of feedback do you get?
Yeah, I think some of my favorite responses, one of my favorite reviews on Amazon was, this memoir is a tribute to how love endures. And that just felt so special to hear that. But I hear things like, it's so helpful. I feel heard. I feel less alone, insightful, that kind of thing. Honest, It feels really good to read those type of reviews. I got a lot of feedback from our patients. Once I published the book, I let my patients know about it because they knew about Harvey and would ask about him through the years. But they would read the book and come back to me and say, I had no idea you were going through all of that. So that was telling me I was putting on a pretty good show at the office.
And it sounds like you met much of your goal then in writing the book, because you said you were writing a teaching memoir.
Yeah, that's a term I found somewhere, and it's really seemed apt. The way I structure the book, each chapter is titled a broad caregiving principle, such as it's better to be kind than correct. And then I illustrate that in the chapter with a story. And then I end it with a discussion of that principle. And then I have practices that a reader may choose to do, be it a journal prompt or drawing a picture or a thought practice to help solidify and cement that broad caregiving principle. Because I found I couldn't just write a straight memoir. I had to teach. Because I feel like that's one of my biggest roles, and probably yours too, as a nurse too, is teaching my patients about better health.
Yes. Many of our authors have written a similar kind of book with a personal story, but with a teaching component to it as well, because people seem to get more out of it that way. Sometimes you want to read someone's story because you can relate to it. And you know, gee, you know, I this person went through this. I'm not alone. Or if she made it, I can make it too. But then when you walk away with a little bit of advice, you know, just even just one or two different things that might make a difference. Yeah. You know, then they get their money's worth, their time's worth. Right?
Exactly. And I felt that just being a physician too gave me a little bit more clout and ability to speak to those things with more authority maybe than.
Yeah.
than others.
I think so. People sometimes they're looking for more authoritative figures, but it's better if it's a person that's actually walked the walk. It's one thing.
Exactly.
If you were writing just about, you know, your experience caring for your patients from that perspective, that's one thing, but to see that this was your life, it means so much more.
Mm-hmm. I think so too.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer. Part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So your husband, was he at home with you the entire time, or did he go to assisted living or long-term care, or what's your experience with that?
Yeah. So yeah, Harvey was able to be home alone for 4 years. And when I could tell that he just did not know how to structure his time, he wandered once, I knew it was time to get in-home care. And I started with about 4 hours, two or three times a week, just to give him some, and I had other things for him scheduled to do. And I used both agencies as well as private. Ended up that the private women were the best. So I just gradually increased the time. So he had home caregivers for 2 years, just gradually increasing the time that they were there with him, so that toward the end of that period, I had someone with him from 6 a.m. till 6 p.m. And then when it was time to, and then I placed him in memory care. And so he was in memory care for 2 years. And that's always a difficult decision mm-hmm. for anybody to make. So I'd like to share a bit from my book just about mm-hmm. that decision to place him in care. So this is, well, before I get to that, I had heard or read that the main reasons people place a loved one in memory care are, number one, incontinence, and number two, sleep. And incontinence was an issue, but I didn't think it was that big an issue. I could deal with poop. I did not realize that before incontinence, because I thought incontinence was going to the bathroom in the diaper. But before they do that, they get an urge and they don't know what they're supposed mm-hmm. to do. That was very difficult to deal with. Grown man poop is not the same as baby poop. But sleep was my absolute. If my sleep was interrupted to the point that I could not function well at work, I was going to have to place him. And my sleep was interrupted by him getting up and going to the bathroom and coming back for about a year. But it didn't seem to bother me the next day at the office until it did, you know, and then it just escalated and he was up and couldn't get settled back in. And I'd have to get up and clean up poop and pee. And I was just near tears one morning and asked one of my caregivers, can you just come spend the night with us while I look for a place? And I slept the best sleep of my life that first night that she stayed with him in the room. But that's what set me on the course to find a memory care unit. So this takes place the day before he has to go in. So the morning Harvey was to move into memory care, he went straight to the bathroom and urinated on the closed toilet lid, and then emerged with a small ball of poop in his hands. And I overreacted because he refused to wash his hands, and we fought. Harvey grabbing my wrists and giving me fierce, angry looks. Eventually, I just stormed out of the bathroom and went to the bedroom and sobbed. My friend Nancy happened to text me during my meltdown, and I told her what had transpired. She actually came right over and brought her iPod loaded with 70s music, music to calm the angry beast. She got him to wash his hands. Then we all danced and sang together. His mood and mine were completely changed by this. When James Taylor's You've Got a Friend began to play, Harvey beckoned me to him and we slow danced, and he tenderly kissed my forehead and cheek 3 times. As we danced, the unit director's words came back to me when she said, "We will care for him so that you can just love him." And that's exactly what that was for me, was giving care to someone else, the job of giving care to professionals who could do it and leave me just to be able to love him. And that's what we would do when I would show up. We would sing and dance, and I would rub his back and comb his hair and eat lunch together and just love him and not have the burden of care. And that was such a beautiful thing for her to say to me.
That's a beautiful way of looking at that. And had you looked at it that way before in your practice?
No, I thought I was a failure at caregiving. My daughters weren't real pleased that I was going to go that route. But, you know, we all realized there was really nothing else to do. One of the issues with younger onset Alzheimer's disease, because they're younger, they're stronger, and they can, when I say fight, he never injured anyone, but he could put up resistance because he's a very strong man. So I couldn't change his clothes, and the caregivers that we had were getting to the point where they couldn't change his clothes. But the caregivers in memory care, it was amazing. One woman, 5 minutes, he was completely changed. It would have taken me an hour.
I think sometimes they're more agreeable when they have somebody like a nurse or an aide helping them than their loved one. There's something there. I know I experienced that with my own family. You said Harvey was, you know, forced into an early retirement due to his diagnosis. And I've spoken to several people about this. And the problem is that you're not eligible for your retirement benefits when you're 50. How did you guys work that out? Was that something you could handle, or didn't get handled?
No, it was actually very easy for us. We had purchased high quality disability insurance. And I remember complaining about it because he wanted us to purchase this huge amount of disability insurance, but thank goodness he did. And then because early onset Alzheimer's disease is a diagnosis that Social Security allows you to get benefits immediately.
Okay, good to know.
Right. So that started in about the same time Harvey was diagnosed. So that's been on the books for over 10 years now. So you just apply, you have the documentation from the physician that it's early onset Alzheimer's, and they are immediately, you don't have that 2-year waiting period. So Harvey actually made more money with disability plus Social Security than I did at the office. So we were fine. And I realized how privileged we are. There are so many people that don't have the resources that we did.
Yeah, that's a big problem that I experienced with my own parents, who ended up having to go on Medicaid because there was no way in the world they could afford his care. I would say that if they had worked and saved all the money they ever earned in their lifetime, they still would not have had enough money to pay for his care at $12,000 a month. It was ludicrous, $400 a day. And he was just clean them, feed them, turn them. That was it. He didn't suck up more resources than that.
Right. And they don't pay their staff hardly anything. It's amazing how expensive it is, yet they don't pay their staff. But it's amazing.
Well, that's been recently exposed because of COVID. And I think that is part of the big problem with the number of deaths at the nursing homes and things like that. And I know from working in them and from having my family there, that there are some major issues, and that I think is going to be addressed at last, because it has to be. Yeah, it's really scary. And in New York, because we had a major crisis with that here. And the governor is feet are in the fire because of it too. And it brings all of that to light, as COVID did to many, many, many mm-hmm. things, especially with people with dementia and the caregiving.
Yeah.
People who are separated from their family members in long-term care or in memory care, families isolated at home with a loved one that, you know, they couldn't get their care.
I know.
Caregivers couldn't come to the house because of quarantine. They couldn't get a break. I mean, I can't even imagine what that was like.
Yeah. I don't know how people are doing it or have done it. It's beyond hard. Anyway, and add that in the mix.
What was the most difficult task you faced as a caregiver, other than the poop?
Just handling everything, being the queen of everything. You know, I think the last chore that he had to give up was caring for the dog. It was his dog, you know, how dogs decide on a person. Well, Nash was always his dog. And when he just could not remember to feed and water and walk, that was just, I have to take care of the dog too. And then the dog got sick and passed away, and I had to hand it. It was just, I'm in charge of everything, you know. But being at work, I did work at the office as a physician the entire time. And I'm realizing that it was life-giving to me, even though I was a caregiver at work. It's different, mm-hmm. but I had purpose. I could have adult conversations and be validated for what I was doing. It was a lifesaver to me. I thought that I would probably retire early to care for him, but I'm glad I didn't in retrospect, because it really was life-saving for me to have that to go to and be affirmed at, and because I enjoy it.
Sure. Yeah, you built your whole life, and he probably would have wanted you to preserve that. You worked on it. It was your life's work together.
Yeah. I would have, if the tables were changed, I think we would have said the same thing about mm-hmm. each other, for sure.
Yeah. Now, what was Harvey's attitude about the whole thing when this came about?
Unfortunately, he did not want to talk about it. We never talked about it. So there was absolutely some denial, but, you know, there's this condition that Alzheimer's patients also have, anosognosia, where they don't have any self-awareness and they don't really understand what's going on with him. So it's hard to tell the difference between the two, but I would try to bring up something, he would shoot me down. He didn't want to talk about it. And that was very difficult for me, to lose the person, my person that I talked to everything about, and not even to be able to talk about the worst thing that ever happened to me with him, because it was happening to him and he didn't want to talk about it. So hence the journaling was very helpful.
Yeah, I can see that. And then you had told me that you didn't publish anything until after he had passed away.
Yes, and that's probably why. You know, there's a little bit of guilt about me talking about it now, but I think he would want people to be aware of what this disease is really like and the best approaches to caregiving. So I'm not feeling all that guilty about it from his point of view.
Yeah, and it's good to get different perspectives out there as well. You know, different people in different professions, and people might think that it wouldn't happen to a doctor.
Yeah.
Or, you know, different socioeconomic backgrounds and things. Everybody has such a different story. There are no two stories alike, I don't think.
Can't be. I mean, our brains are so different. Mm. And when a disease affects the brain, it's going to affect that person completely differently. You know, the phrase, if you've seen one patient with Alzheimer's, you've seen one patient with Alzheimer's. Yep, absolutely.
In addition to your daughters, did you have anyone else in your family or friends that were helpful to you on this journey?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, indeed. So my parents are in town, and they were a great support emotionally for me, but they were responsible for staying with Harvey while I went to support group. So my support group was just down the street from their house. So I would drop him off for support group. And my sister was in town, and she helped me look at memory care units, but that was it for family. Harvey and I had been involved in our church for many years, and we had deep connection and deep friendships in this church. And so as I told my friends what was going on, they were very supportive. And like most people do, if there's anything you want, just let us know. If there's anything we can do for you, just let us know. And I never did. But my counselor early on asked me, who is on your team? And I couldn't come up with anybody except my daughters and my parents. And that was not a big enough team. But as time went on, I was vulnerable about what was going on at home with my friends. And they would just offer specific help. So, for example, I played keyboards at my church, and Harvey would come with me and sit while we were practicing, but he started wandering. And our church is downtown and wasn't a particularly, well, it's never a safe thing to do, wander out of a church. So I told a friend that I was going to have to stop playing keyboard in the church. And he said, no, I'll come sit with Harvey during practice. And so Bill became Harvey's, I call him a shepherd during that time period while I practice, and then I could meet up with him. Another time I had this great idea that I was going to hire a chef. I was sick of working all day, coming home and cooking dinner every single night. I was exhausted. So I was going to hire a chef to come in one day a week, someone who knew us. I had someone in mind to cook with Harvey, meal prep, and then I could pull on that during the week to eat. So I told my friend Nancy about this. And she said, no, you don't do that. I'll come cook with Harvey. And once a week, and Nancy would tell you, she's not a cook. She doesn't cook. But once a week, she would show up with recipes, and they would go to the grocery store. They'd come home. She'd turn on her 70s music. This is Nancy that I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And they would cook a meal together. And Harvey could chop and stir and open the can, use the can opener. We had a very funky can opener that only he and I know how to use. And then she would stay and eat dinner with us. So we would have, I would have my friend and Harvey for dinner. And that was just a beautiful thing. So things like that just kept happening. I would just, because I was vulnerable with my friends and tell them what was going on, and they were creative enough to think of ways to help me. A neighbor down the street noticed that Harvey wasn't walking the dog anymore. He had forgotten. So she called and said, hey, I'd like to walk dogs with Harvey. And she and her black lab puppy would show up twice a week, and they'd go walking together.
That's wonderful. Those are really good examples of what people can do if they want to do something. People generally are just paralyzed because they're unsure. They don't want to stick their nose in where it might not be welcome, or told to mind their own business, or make a mistake.
If you offer something specific, like, may I cook dinner for you on Thursday? Can I cut your grass for you this week? You know, they might say no, but they might say yes. It's better than asking, what can I do to help? Which to me always felt like one more burden you're putting on me to come up with something that you can do for me. I know that it was coming from a good place, but it felt like a burden to try to think of something they could do.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of times people are looking for something to do, especially older people, if they're not working anymore, or, you know, they have a big family and they might be lonely, and doing a favor for you might be a great thing for them that day, even if it's just to take the dog for a walk or run to the grocery store, the pharmacy, or whatever.
Absolutely.
So you might be helping them by asking them to help you.
I think they would, my friends who helped out that way would say that it was expansive for them. It opened their world, opened their eyes, helped them understand. Some of them have since become caregivers to their parents, and it just helped them understand our world a lot better too, and gave them something meaningful to do, like you said.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So where can listeners find your book and your blog?
So I have a website. It's reneharmon.com. And there's a link on that first page to purchase the book through Amazon. But you can purchase the book anywhere. So it's on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Walmart. You can go to your local independent bookstore and ask them to order it, because I've got distribution set up for that. The blog is on the website as well. There are links to me doing storytelling and some lectures and some of my other writings having to do with Alzheimer's. I've written some articles that have been published. They're all on that website too. I'm happy to announce that a story that I wrote for Chicken Soup of the Soul is going to be published June 22nd. They have an edition called Navigating Elder Care and Dementia that's coming out in June. So I'll have a story in there.
I had a story published in Chicken Soup of the Soul called Mom Knows Best. And it was a dementia story that I shared about my mom, her 90th birthday. We had to do it in the nursing facility because she was recovering from a fractured hip, and her husband was there, and he had been unresponsive, not even opening his eyes for like a long time until that day. And we brought him into the room with everybody. There were about 25 friends and family there, and he woke up and he even spoke, and he ate cake. So that was like her best birthday present ever. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Yeah, this story I wrote just fit exactly their navigating elder care. I wrote about college trip that we took with our oldest daughter looking for her college, took a road trip with Harvey and our oldest daughter. And I'd forgotten to pack maps. I love maps. And we were just depending on the GPS completely, which was driving me crazy until we crossed a state line. And I said, we've got to stop and get a map. Anyway, it ended up being a metaphor for being just thrown into Alzheimer's world without a map. And what constituted my map? I developed my map as I went, and what were my guideposts along the way? So,
and then it would all could all be changed if there, you know, were another person to care for them. That might not work for them.
Right. So you have to have your own map. You can't, there is no one guidebook for everyone.
The crux of it all, I think, that makes it so difficult for people, because what works for you might not work for me, or might work today and it might not work tomorrow. And it might have worked for your mother, but it doesn't work for your father, your spouse. In addition to journaling, what else did you use for self-care?
You know, I think the creative thing I did, and I didn't realize it was self-care, is I kept doing the things that brought me joy in the past, but I modified them. So I'm a big reader, and I would read novels. I would sequester myself down somewhere and read my novel. But after working all day, I didn't want to come home and not interact with Harvey. So I started doing audiobooks in my car on the way to and from work. I played the piano, and he didn't particularly care for the type of music I like to play. So I bought a 70s songbook and would play these songs, Billy Joel and Elton John, and we would sing those together. I taught myself how to knit and how to crochet, just using YouTube videos so that I could sit and do that while we were together. I had a studio at my house in the basement, kind of my woman she shed down in the basement. Again, I didn't want to just take myself away. So I needed something that was small that I could do. I picked up Zentangle, which is a small art form with pen and ink kind of drawing thing that I could do in my lab. We continued to travel. We took some big bucket list trips. It was a lot of work, but we rafted down the Grand Canyon the first year that Harvey was diagnosed, like very early on. And we went to Belize, and we flew to Seattle, took a train, overnight train to Glacier. Again, every trip I did, I was gearing it to what Harvey was capable of. And when he couldn't travel anymore, I continued to take shorter trips and would ask my daughters to watch him while I went on a trip with a friend or by myself. And then we would take small trips, just one daughter and myself. But all those things to me felt like self-care, helped me feel more normal doing the things that I normally would do. So for example, if you love gardening and you know you can't spend all that time outside at your garden, you know, you just modify that and make a container garden on your front porch that you and your loved one could do together, for example. So there are ways to keep doing the things that you love to do if you think about it creatively.
Thank you for listening to Untangling Alzheimer's and Dementia, an All's Authors podcast. For more details on this episode, please see the show notes. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review and subscribe to it on whichever platform you use to listen to your favorite podcasts. For more information on All's Authors, please visit allsauthors.com. While you're there, be sure to browse our online bookstore, where you will find hundreds of carefully vetted books on Alzheimer's and dementia. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Please email your thoughts on the podcast to allsauthors@gmail.com. We are a 501c3 charitable organization, totally reliant on donations to do what we do. If our author stories move you, please consider contributing to our cause. Remember, you are not alone. One can sing a lonely song, but we chose to form a choir and create harmony.
It's the Bowtie Guy again, Christopher McClellan. I'm confident you enjoyed this first episode of Untangling Dementia and Alzheimer's, featured on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. And be sure to visit allsauthors.com to learn more about their amazing authors, books, and other podcasts. Next week, we'll be introducing you to certified caregiver consultant Elizabeth Miller. Elizabeth is the presenter of Happy Healthy Caregiver, and she has quite the story to share with you. We'll have more information about Elizabeth coming up next week as her show debuts on UK Health Radio. And speaking of UK Health Radio, don't go anywhere. Our next show will be starting right after this quick break. Make it a great day. We'll see you soon. Bye for now.